From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And everything has changed. Of course, that's been slowly happening since the coronavirus outbreak. But today, thousands, maybe millions of Americans woke up out of work. Over the weekend, the CDC recommended a ban on gatherings of 50 people or more. States have their own restrictions. Massachusetts banned all gatherings over 25. So suddenly, restaurants, health clubs, small businesses are furloughing workers with no pay. Trading on Wall Street halted again for 15 minutes as markets fell. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst for CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Jill, this is how small businesses work. No money coming in dinners or lessons, no payroll.
Right. And so these small business owners, and, you know, we're mostly thinking about when you think about, like, how is a small business defined? The SBA, the Small Business Administration, says anyone less than 500 employees. But obviously, the smaller the business, the deeper the problems that occur. And you're absolutely right. I mean, what we know is that people simply do not have the wherewithal to be able to manage this process. And that's why I think there had been some hope that the federal government would act and act sooner rather than later, clearly, because what we are considering right now is a situation where, yeah, people might lay off their employees, but they may not be able to survive as going concerns. And that, to me, is the real critical issue. We've got to give these the workers, but also the small business owners, a lifeline.
Well, the House on Sunday voted to pass a bill that will give employees 2 weeks of paid sick leave if they work at a company with 500 employees or fewer. Bigger companies like Walmart and Target are saying they too will voluntarily provide 2 weeks of paid sick leave. But, you know, for those, let's stay with the employees for a second. You know, people worried about their insurance running out. You have always told people to have, what, a 3-month backup of cash? Most people don't. What can they do?
Well, I mean, I think that this is the sort of the triage version of your financial life. And I understand, when I must sound like a broken record when I say 3 to 6 months of your living expenses and more if you're already retired. But you're here now. And if you don't have that, or even if you do have that, here's where you start. You make a list of your expenses. And I would say, kind of in order, food and shelter, the most important part of this, okay? You're never going to skimp on that. So food and shelter come first. Obviously, utilities and car payments and insurance and servicing your debt and medical or pharmaceutical expenses, even dependent care. I mean, there are plenty of people who are paying for their older relatives to be in assisted living or in homes or home health aids, and they can't afford to shut that off right now. So you've got to make sure you understand what the priorities are. I will say that, in terms of those must pay expenses, it used to be I would always say, oh, utilities, because you don't want your utilities shut off. But most states, and I'm pretty sure all will, they're banning any utility shutoffs, you know, heat and water and electricity during the national emergency. So I think that you don't have to worry about that. What I'm not sure is if that would apply to internet service providers, because if everyone's working from home, you need your internet service provider.
Yeah, but stay with people who aren't working at home. I mean, people who are working at home are the lucky ones.
Yes.
Those who just are being told, we can't afford to pay you and we're tremendously sorry. What about their employers? As you said, they also have to think about how long they can go without functioning and whether they're going to go under. We've been hearing anecdotally about, a climbing club that had a close and said, look, you can stop your dues, but we're hoping that you keep paying your monthly dues even though you're not coming so we can pay the staff. And we've heard of, young people saying, I'm going to do that. Or a suggestion that if something closes, you buy a gift certificate to it, like, to put money in now that you can then use the facility later.
Right. I mean, those are great ideas. Unfortunately, that's really not what's needed. What is needed is a whole scale federal government intervention right here. You know, like when the financial system gets clogged up, it's the Federal Reserve that steps in. When our consumers and small businesses, when they're cash flow gets clogged up, when they are in need, we must have the federal government act and act swiftly. So I feel like they're on the precipice of potentially doing that, but we need it now. Mm-hmm. A couple of things that I should just point out. The FDIC has issued a statement to banks saying that they think that banks, they can't make them do it, but they believe banks should waive fees like ATM fees and overdraft fees and late fees on credit cards and other loans. They think that there should be increasing credit card limits for creditworthy borrowers, and they want the banks to offer payment accommodation, like allowing a borrower to skip or defer some payments or extending the payment due date. So I'm hopeful that the banks and the lending institutions are going to step in where the government is failing right now.
Well, and just real quick, Jill, the Federal Reserve did cut interest rates to practically zero. Will that make it easier for small businesses to apply for loans to get money?
Yes, but it's not the panacea. We need to get money into these people's pockets now. And that's not going to happen efficiently if you have to go through a loan process, even if it's expedited. So it's better, but it really is not the cure. And remember, there really isn't a cure right this minute. What has happened is the economy, which was going along at 55 miles an hour at the beginning of this year, has screeched, and the economy's in a skid. We don't know whether we end up in a ditch or we end up like, oh, that was scary, but we're okay. Because of that uncertainty, that's what investors need to see government action take place right now.
And remember, that's what happened after the 2008 housing crisis. A lot of money was poured into the economy. There was some criticism of that, but that's how we got through. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always.
Great to be with you.
Georgia has pushed its primaries from late March until May over coronavirus fears. Louisiana has also postponed its presidential primaries. But the four states originally scheduled to vote tomorrow with nearly 600 delegates are still on. That's Ohio, Arizona, Illinois, and Florida, the biggest prize of tomorrow night. For more on that, we have with us Tom Hudson, vice president of news and a special correspondent at WLRN in Miami. Welcome, Tom.
Great to be with you. Thanks for the time today.
Yeah, so let's start with the big news, of course. How is this coronavirus affecting the state's primary there?
Well, it is not in terms of it still being held. There are a handful of polling places that county election supervisors have moved because those polling places are in senior living facilities or retirement homes. Mm. And as you may know, the governor has stopped visitors from going to those locations because of the vulnerable population to COVID-19. But otherwise, it is, dare I say, business as usual in terms of at least holding the primary.
Yeah. Have they talked about any precautions that are being taken and tips for people as they go to those polls?
Yeah. Social distancing, hand sanitizer. I was at a polling place, an early polling place over the weekend, and they had a freestanding hand sanitizer machine right there as you were waiting in line to get all of your documents checked. There's been some concern stated early on that they may have trouble fully staffing all the polling places because of concerns about social distancing from the poll workers.
Yeah. Last night in the debate in D.C., both candidates made the argument that they're the best leader in this time of crisis. I'm wondering, as Floridians go to the polls with this crisis in mind, who's got the lead there?
Joe Biden, undoubtedly. The former vice president has a large margin over the Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, and that's expected to really be pretty solid as we'll see the results on Tuesday night.
Biden has the lead, but also last night, Bernie Sanders refused to back down on his comments praising Cuba's late communist dictator Fidel Castro, or at least Castro's literacy program. How have those Castro comments played out in Florida, which has a very large Cuban population?
Yeah, certainly here in South Florida, where I'm talking to you from in Miami, they haven't played out at all. The Vermont senator wasn't doing well with Cuban Americans to begin with. And then the statements that were aired on 60 Minutes a few weeks ago just deepened the hole that he was in. And then, of course, him continuing to essentially double down on his nuanced statement regarding the Castro regime has not brought him any favors when it comes to the Cuban American voting bloc here. A Telemundo poll from early March found that Cuban voters, for instance, would choose President Trump over Democratic candidate Sanders, 74% to 19%. And Cuban voters also favored the president over even the former Vice President Joe Biden, although the margin, while still large, was less than what it was for Bernie Sanders.
You know, this primary is very important. It probably would be the top story right now if people's minds weren't on coronavirus. What's going on there in Florida? Can you give us an idea, especially with the state's very large tourism industry?
It is reeling. We have seen this story move so fast. I've never experienced an economic story like this. Over the course of Friday through Sunday, we had the cruise industry coming to a standstill for 30 days. We had American Airlines, which is the predominant major legacy carrier serving Miami and Latin America, announce that it will end more than a dozen routes into Latin America and into Miami through May. So the industry simply just does not have any ability to figure out what Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday will bring, let alone what April and May. And this is the high season. This is the time when this industry gets its business, and big concern about how it's going to be able to withstand anything that stretches more than a month or so.
That's WLRN's Tom Hudson in Miami. Thank you so much for this update, Tom.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
So where are we on testing for the coronavirus? There's been a lot of criticism. The NIH's Anthony Fauci said the U.S. isn't set up for the idea of anybody getting tested easily, as happens in other countries. But the White House has a goal of testing tens of thousands by the end of this week. Here's Vice President Pence at the White House yesterday.
We will now have access in the days ahead to more than 2,000 labs across the country that have the equipment today to process coronavirus tests much more rapidly and a much higher volume for the American people. In terms of delivering those services, more than 10 states, in addition to CDC labs, and public health labs, and labs that states can now authorize in their states, more than 10 states have implemented their own drive-through testing sites.
So hopefully that will unfold as planned. But what about a vaccine? Human trials of one begin today, reportedly including 45 healthy volunteers at the Kaiser Permanente Research Institute in Seattle. It's a vaccine funded by the National Institutes of Health and co-developed by biotech company Moderna. We spoke with them last month. Well, today we want to check in with Dr. Dan Baruch, director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Now, he's known for his work on vaccines for the Zika virus and HIV, which causes AIDS, and is now in the race for a coronavirus vaccine. Dr. Baruch, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
So remind us of where we are here. You and others say it was critical that Chinese officials actually released the genetic sequence of this new coronavirus, the one that causes COVID-19. That's helped you?
Absolutely. The sequence of the coronavirus was released on January 10th, and that allowed us and many other groups to start working on a vaccine immediately. In fact, our team started to analyze the sequence that same day. And we worked through the weekend to develop vaccine immunogens that could be used for vaccine development.
So, again, we have the DNA, which is the roadmap. And as we understand it, the Moderna vaccine uses RNA. This translates genetic information in DNA into proteins. The Moderna vaccine set up these, you know, so-called custom-built messenger RNAs, sent them in there to produce an immune response to the coronavirus. Your vaccines, we understand, have two approaches. One also has to do with DNA. The other is related to the common cold. Can you briefly tell us what your hope is?
So these all are part of a class of vaccines called gene-based vaccines. We take just a piece of the virus, DNA or RNA, and we use that as a vaccine. This is different than traditional vaccine methods, which would use the entire virus as the vaccine.
And what is the basic thinking? Is it to trick the body into, you know, forming an immunity to the virus?
Yes. So we are producing DNA vaccines as well as recombinant adenovirus vector-based vaccines, which means that a piece of the coronavirus is encoded in a piece of DNA called a plasmid or into a common cold virus that is harmless. Once injected into the body, these are carriers that take the gene of interest, the coronavirus piece, into cells. The host then makes the protein, and we make an immune response to that protein.
How is it different now because of technology? Is it just you can get to the genetic coding of the virus faster? I mean, how is it different today than maybe 50 years ago?
There's several important differences. First, we have recombinant DNA technology, which means we can go directly from the sequence of the virus of interest to vaccine constructs much more quickly than we used to. Secondly, the techniques to develop vaccines are very different. For example, the DNA vaccines, the RNA vaccines, and the live recombinant vector-based vaccines didn't exist 50 years ago.
Well, we understand there are many hoping for this holy grail. Texas Children's Hospital and Dr. Peter Hotez. Dr. Hotez, by the way, is also talking about a serum treatment that would help infected patients created by drawing antibodies from the blood of patients who've recovered from COVID-19. Very exciting. We're going to talk to him tomorrow. But Hotez and his team are also working on prevention, are using a SARS vaccine that was shelved when SARS, which, a reminder, is another coronavirus, faded away. Their vaccine has been frozen since then. He says, you know, it's like hockey. You want to take as many shots on the goal as you can. You agree, right?
Absolutely. The race is not against other vaccine developers. The race is against the virus and the epidemic. There's actually a lot of collaboration and working together amongst people who are engaged in this. It's needed to have multiple different vaccines move forward. In fact, the parallel development of multiple vaccines against the coronavirus is really essential because at this point in time, we do not know which vaccines will prove the safest, the most effective, the most durable, and also the most deployable.
Yeah. I want to talk about your HIV vaccine. It's still not on the market after years and years of research, but how hopeful. And we understand it's in clinical trials. But why did that take so long? The outbreak was in the 80s.
For HIV, vaccine development has presented unique and unprecedented scientific challenges. It's not a single virus sequence, but rather a countless number of different virus sequences throughout the world, in any region, and even in a single infected individual. So for HIV, we don't know exactly which sequence to use. For the coronavirus, as well as other pathogens like Zika virus, so far sequences are relatively homogeneous. So we have a much clearer target. In addition, for HIV, there isn't a single person that we know of that has recovered and cleared the virus through their own immune system. Whereas for more traditional viruses like Zika virus, like the coronavirus, then most people who get infected do recover. So we have experiments of nature that show us that it's possible for the immune system to conquer the virus.
Well, I just want to jump here to make sure that we make clear. People who have HIV, you say that the virus might not clear out from their body, but they don't necessarily get full-blown AIDS and they don't necessarily get sick.
For HIV-infected individuals, there is no known case of an HIV-infected individual completely clearing the virus and being cured based on their own immune responses. We can control the virus with medications, and those are life-saving. However, so far, we're not able to cure them. And the important point from that is that for HIV, there are unique scientific challenges that are unprecedented in the history of vaccinology.
Well, and, you know, of course, we wish you the best of luck with yours. But yours also, you know, the platform that you've used for that and for Zika is now helping you with your work on the coronavirus. Let's just go back to that for a second. What does it feel like in the lab? I mean, when there's this race against time.
So first, there is no way that we could have moved so quickly in the development of a coronavirus vaccine if it wasn't for the fact that we have developed these platform technologies for other pathogens in the past, such as HIV and Zika. But nevertheless, there's a huge sense of urgency amongst everyone in the lab who's working on this. Long days, no weekends, to try to move things forward even just a little bit faster.
Yeah. And back to the Moderna vaccine. Again, this is from another company. It's now being tested on humans, volunteers. I would think these people who are volunteering to do this are, that's pretty spectacular.
For a clinical trial of a new vaccine, the volunteers are educated that this is an experimental vaccine. We don't know for sure whether it will work or not. And there also may be risks that we don't know about yet. That being said, these technologies have been used in humans for other pathogens, yeah. So for other virus vaccines. So although they are new and they could have unexpected adverse effects, we are relatively sure that the vaccines will be safe. How effective they will be remains unknown.
Well, that is the last question. What do you think? When do you think there might be a vaccine?
It's very difficult to say when there will be a vaccine for coronavirus. What I can tell you is that the timeline to initiating the first in-human phase one clinical trial is not the same as the timeline for when a vaccine will be available to the public. For example, it might only take a few months to get a vaccine into a clinical trial, but there's still a lot of work that has to be done before the vaccine can be tested in large numbers of people, can be manufactured at hundreds of millions of doses, and deployed in clinical populations across the world.
There's a cautionary tale here. We still know how much the everyday flu kills, and there's a vaccine for that. So hopefully people's memories won't fade, and when the vaccine comes for COVID-19, they take it. I think the flu shots now is at 45%.
Absolutely. Well, when there is a vaccine against coronavirus, then there will be a lot of discussion as to how it will be deployed, and it will be very much dependent on where the epidemic is at that point in time. There is a possibility that such a vaccine will be needed to end the epidemic. However, if the epidemic resolves through public health measures, which of course is what we would hope, a vaccine would still be very useful for the next epidemic or a future epidemic.
Dr. Dan Baruch, director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, also well known for his groundbreaking research on HIV and Zika vaccines, and he's joined the race for the coronavirus vaccine. Dr. Baruch, Dan, thank you so much and best to you.
Thank you very much.
Today, the number of infections around the world surpassed those in China. Millions of people in the U.S. and Europe are holed up at home as countries and states tighten restrictions on how many can gather. Italy has the most cases in Europe, more than 24,000, followed by Spain and France. Let's bring in the BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris. Hugh, there are already more than 5,000 infections in France. The head of that country's health service said today, the situation there is only getting worse. It sounds dire. Tell us more.
Yeah, the medical profession in France is detectably angry, I think, at the lack of seriousness which they see in the French population. We've had in France a series of warnings and a series of steps, which are pretty drastic, schools being shut, restaurants, cafes being shut. But over the weekend here in Paris, for example, where there was great weather, people were out and about in the parks along the banks of the River Seine in groups, hobnobbing as if the warnings had never been made. So today, Monday, the country has woken up with this clarion alarm call from the medical profession, and particularly from the chief medical officer there, saying, look, things are getting very, very serious. The number of cases is doubling every 3 days. That's exponential. Doesn't sound like, 5,000 cases doesn't sound much now, but when that's doubled a few times, it'll seem very, very serious. So it is time for the country to really wake up. And we are kind of expecting the government to follow that lead and announce more stringent measures in the hours to come.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, can't they see what's happening in Italy, you know, where people are, you know, are staying at home and singing to each other from their apartment windows? And do you think that the government will do things like send the gendarmes out to arrest people on the street?
Well, I mean, you're right. The sort of the tension between France and Italy in this matter has been very apparent from the start. The French, you know, have been rather superior and supercilious in their attitude towards the Italians, as if it couldn't happen here. But I think it's just human psychology. I mean, you don't really get it until it's right at your door. And it hasn't really been right at the door of the French until now. And now it's sort of kicking in. And now the seriousness of it is really being felt. So that's an answer to the first of your question. As to, you know, what the government's going to do, well, it's expected that they're going to announce some kind of confinement, more rigorous confinement. We don't know that, but that's a speculation. How it'll be enforced, I just don't know. I mean, it seems to me that in Spain and in Italy, it's being enforced by encouragement and by being police on the streets. I haven't heard anyone being fined or sent to prison or anything like that. Yeah. And I imagine it'll be something similar here, that there will be the security forces, police, army even, I don't know, will be out there telling people what to do. But I very much doubt that they'll be imposing fines.
Yeah. The BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, here are just a few more notes about the coronavirus around the world today. Iran reported another 129 deaths. That's the largest one-day rise in fatalities since Iran began battling what is the worst COVID-19 outbreak in the Middle East. There are also now confirmed cases in at least 30 of the 54 countries in Africa. And millions of people in the Philippines are under quarantine. COVID-19 has killed dozens in that Southeast Asian nation. So stay with us. Stay home if you can. We will take you around the world.
Medical experts are saying the worst on coronavirus is yet to come. And according to projections by Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, millions of people will need medical help. But he says there simply aren't enough hospital and intensive care beds or ventilators in the U.S. to treat the people who might need them. And that's why New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo is calling for the Army Corps of Engineers to retrofit military bases and college dorms for temporary medical facilities. One New York hospital CEO joins us to talk about what they're doing. Michael Dowling is president and CEO of New York State's largest healthcare provider, Northwell Health, and former New York State Health Secretary. Welcome, Michael.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad to be on. Thank you.
So tell us, are your 23 hospitals ready?
Yes, we're pretty well prepared. We have been organizing for this for a long time. We have reached out to all of the retired doctors and all of the retired nurses, and people have actually been writing to me, volunteering to come back. So we've reached out to all of them. Now, obviously, this is going to get worse over the next month or two. I believe that is going to accelerate, so that we have to intensify our efforts and make sure that we have the staff and the capacity and the supplies to deal with it. And I'm pretty comfortable, though, that for the overall, that we are in pretty good position here.
Okay, I hear you on that. But last week I spoke with two Italian doctors who shared how their hospitals are overflowing. And we've seen reports where patients are treated based on whether they survive. What are you most worried about?
For me, it's the biggest issue, and I think all of this can be overcome. I happen to be somebody that believes that you have to look at the bright side of things rather than always the negative, because the negative only feeds anxiety. You have to make sure that you have the staff available, because staff do get infected. And if staff people come in contact with somebody that's infected, then they have to go and be quarantined for a period of time. So you have to manage that very, very well. And then obviously the supplies. I mean, the masks, the gloves, the gowns, the vents. And if you have a huge spike, we are doing everything at the moment to enhance our supplies, our inventory of all of those supplies. And if those things happen the way I believe it will happen, I then think that we'll be in a pretty good position But we always have to be prepared, of course, for something to spike beyond what I think it might happen. And then we will have to adapt and be flexible.
On Friday, you and the governor opened the first drive-through testing site on the East Coast. How is that testing going?
That testing is going very, very well. And it's started on Friday, as you mentioned, and it's operating successfully. We will be opening, I believe, others. Some of those are in the planning stages right now. But that allows people to drive in. They don't have to get out of their cars. When I was there on Friday, you know, there were like 10, 15 cars in a line, and it moves very, very quickly. People are swabbed through the windows of the car. So it's a quick process. And obviously, the more you test, the more you're able to isolate, the more you're able to treat. And as you know, we're only testing those people that are sick and those people that have been in contact with somebody that has a confirmed case. Of course, the more you test, the more cases you're going to find. And that's what's going to drive the spike.
You mentioned earlier that you feel optimistic. You think that we'll make it through this crisis. You're still feeling as confident as you were on Friday.
Yes, because we're faced with these issues all the time. I mean, we had Ebola, we had H1N1, we had the Hurricane Sandy. You've got to make sure that your staff that are working on the front lines all the time and that demonstrate unbelievable compassion and commitment here, that they see that their work is valued and that we are going to defeat this issue. It may be a rough couple of months. And as I've said many times, it's not what happens to you that matters, it's how you respond to it. And healthcare organizations are very adaptable and they're very resilient. And the one thing I believe that this whole event demonstrates for us as a country is that we have to rebuild up our public health infrastructure. We were not as prepared overall as we should have been nationally. And I think when this is over, I believe that there needs to be an investment, a strengthening and an acceleration of investment in research, in public health infrastructure, in the staffing of the CDC, in the inventory, increasing the inventories of supplies in our storehouses around the place. Those are the kinds of things that we've got to be focusing on, because after this is over, at some point in the future, there will be another one. And so we have to learn the lessons of this one. And while I believe we will succeed here, I do believe it teaches us a lesson about how to be better prepared overall as a country for the next one, because there will be such a case.
That's Michael Dowling. He's president and CEO of New York State's largest healthcare provider, Northwell Health, and former New York State Health Secretary. Mr. Dowling, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very, very much.
Older adults are the most vulnerable to infection from coronavirus. And while attention is focused on the deaths in nursing homes, the vast majority of older adults live independently. In fact, more than 1 million live in affordable housing regulated by the federal government. And the owners of those buildings say the Department of Housing and Urban Development has provided almost no guidance on protecting their vulnerable tenants. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
80-year-old Margie Ramirez moved into Bethany Center in San Francisco's Mission District on July 4th, 2011, and she's been busy ever since.
On Tuesday, it's a Latin exercise class, and they do a little hip-hop.
There are art classes on Wednesday and Thursday and another one on Friday.
We were working on portraits the last time I went.
But that life has come to a screeching halt. Group activities have been canceled, says Ramirez, replaced by isolation.
With this virus going on, I kind of stay up in my room. I find things to do. I read or watch TV or I'm on the computer after a couple of weeks, it probably is going to be harder.
Beyond basic advice like hand washing and social distancing, she says no one has talked to her about what would happen if one of her neighbors fell ill or if there were quarantines in the building. That may be because the building owners haven't been told either.
That absolutely should be coming from HUD,
says Mary McMullen, spokeswoman for Covia, the owner of six buildings offering affordable housing for seniors. HUD is responsible, she says, because while the affordable buildings are owned by nonprofits like CoVIA, it's HUD that regulates them and foots the bill.
HUD should be advising us where we would be able to get things like additional supplies for cleaning or emergency funding if we needed additional staff, or how we manage visitors coming to our communities.
Because while the residents in these buildings live independently, they receive supportive services in their homes like so many other older adults.
Hospice nurses come in, home health providers come in, and we really need HUD to let us know how we can manage a situation of this magnitude with the small resources that are available to an affordable housing community.
Providers of affordable senior housing have so many questions, says Linda Couch, Vice President for Housing Policy at Leading Age, which represents thousands of nonprofits that provide services for older adults. In fact, her organization sent a letter with more than a dozen questions to Vice President Pence, who heads the administration's coronavirus task force, and HUD Secretary Ben Carson.
We wrote the letter to try to sound the alarm within the task force that here is a very large and very at-risk population screaming out for some guidance from HUD.
HUD has not yet answered Leading Age's letter. The agency also declined NPR's request for an interview. But it did put out additional guidance for affordable housing operators on Thursday. That document acknowledges that there's no emergency plan for infectious disease outbreaks, but says it will take lessons from the current crisis to develop one. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
And we've, of course, been following the economic fallout from COVID-19. Another big dive in the stock market today, triggering the third halt to trading in recent days. And then those layoffs at restaurants, bakeries, travel agencies, fitness clubs, as people are told to stay home. Let's call up somebody who's at home. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, D.C., as he does each Monday. And Derek, you are self-quarantining. You're among the lucky Americans who can work from home. We're talking about people who are out of work at home, but you're working from home. Welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you, Robin.
Yeah. And as you well know, the Federal Reserve cut rates to near zero over the weekend. But Jill Schlesinger told us at the top of the hour, yeah, that will help small businesses borrow money, but that takes time. And besides, we need to just give money to businesses and to people, to employees who are at home. You agree, and you go further. You say cold, hard cash.
Cold hard cash is what we need. The Federal Reserve's move is important. It's important to keep credit flowing, especially when you're looking at an economic crisis. You don't want a health crisis, an economic crisis, to turn into a financial crisis. So the Federal Reserve's move is really important, but it's not enough. We need cold hard cash in the hands of families. We need cold hard cash in the hands of people who are working from home, whose work might be disrupted, and we need it in the hands of people who are inevitably going to be laid off. Because you look across this economy, you look what's happening in the leisure and hospitality sector of the economy. Restaurants are getting crushed. Airlines are getting crushed. Airports, anyone who works in an airport, they could potentially lose their job as well, as you see airlines pull back on the number of flights that they're offering. People are going to lose their jobs, thousands, maybe millions. Yeah. And the federal government has to respond to this. It's not only a public health crisis, but also an economic crisis that is akin to the Great Recession when we did hand out cold, hard cash. So that is what we have to start thinking about immediately.
Let's remind people, this is 2008. George W. Bush signed an economic stimulus that mailed checks to families within 6 weeks of the bill's passage. This was after the housing collapse, when the whole economy almost collapsed.
That's right. George W. Bush signed a law that sent checks to over 100 million people's houses. Those checks were about a couple hundred dollars. We need something, I think, closer to $1,000 or $1,500 per family, maybe a couple hundred dollars per child as well. Because, you know, you compare this to the Great Recession. And in many ways, there is no comparison. In the Great Recession, schools were not closed down. In the Great Recession, restaurants were not closed down. Business did not come to an absolute sudden standstill. We're looking at something that really has no precedent in the last 100 years. There has never been a time in a service sector economy when services were essentially shut down for public health reasons across not only the U.S., but also the world. Mm. So we need to respond to this in a big, big way. I think it's one of these go big or go home situations. Mm-hmm. I say give thousands of dollars to families immediately, and that will help them not only wait out this recession, but also hopefully we'll get through this and we'll have growth again and health again and public life again in the summer. And we want families to be able to emerge from that and say, I've got hundreds of dollars that I can spend in local community businesses, and that will lead to a V-shaped recovery, a quick bounce back, and not a long, dragged-out recession.
Well, this is what President Obama did after the Great Recession, poured money into the economy. You're talking about cash directly to people. Now, the Trump administration has proposed a payroll tax cut. We understand, and you're right, that will get workers money, but mainly the white-collar, already working at home workers. It doesn't help the people we're talking about as much, those who are getting furloughed today as we speak.
Yeah, I think let's be fair to the administration here. There are good reasons for a payroll tax cut and there are bad reasons. The good reason for a payroll tax cut is that it's really, really fast. You can start giving people money almost immediately. Almost everything else, I think, is a weakness about it. It tends to help people who need the least help. It tends to help higher income white collar workers who, like me, can just work from home. So our jobs are not threatened by something like a public health crisis. It also doesn't give people money in a really fast and big way because you're only taking a little bit of their paycheck and bumping it up a little bit every 2 weeks. I think people need $1,000 as soon as possible. And finally, it doesn't do anything for people who are not working. And lots of people are going to lose their jobs in this recession. That's what we need to think about. So we need to bump up unemployment insurance, paid leave, and just give $1,000 to every family, no matter what they're doing.
Talk about unemployment insurance, because as you know, the federal government already jointly funds jobless benefits with states. But you say they really got to bump up this, you know, the amount of money people get when they're suddenly furloughed, laid off, unemployed.
Yeah, I think thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people are going to lose their jobs in the next few months, especially in the leisure and hospitality industry. When they do lose their jobs, we need to have a really, really strong safety net that's going to catch them. Only the federal government has the ability to borrow at a really, really cheap rate and run an enormous deficit in order to fund that safety net. So I say run a huge deficit right now, put a lot of money into unemployment insurance, make sure that people who do lose their jobs have money in their pocket that they can spend now to keep their families afloat. And later, when we come out of this recession, that's what we need to be thinking about right now.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. By the way, you know, self-quarantining at home, as you know, so many reporters are doing now to keep their workplace safe. Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Go out to everyone impacted by this crisis, which we'll continue to cover. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.